Hello and welcome to LPO Offstage with me, Yolanda Brown. With Series 7 of the podcast, we're bringing LPO Offstage to a close, but there's loads to go back and listen to, and I'll be launching a new LPO podcast soon, so watch this space. This final series has touched on topics as wide-ranging as retirement, Christmas, classical music in film and TV, and more tales from epic tours, plus repertoire deep dives into Stravinsky's Firebird, Wagner's Ring Cycle, Brahms's symphonies, and Holst's The Planets. So let's revisit some of the best bits from Series 7, starting with a brilliant story from the notorious Bus 3. This one is from trombonist Mark Templeton, and it has a Christmassy theme.
Now, for podcast listeners,
yes,
who've heard about Bus 3 before,
we've talked about Bus 3. I've booked my seat already, yes.
So, when we're on tour around Christmas time, doing the German tour, sometimes we will have a bus journey like after a concert to a hotel that's maybe an hour away, and that's when we really get singing.
Or two.
But one of the songs we sing is the 12 Days of Touring.
Oh.
To the tune of 12 Days of Christmas. And Simon Estelle normally leads it, our concert bassoon player. And he'll basically, when we get to each event, it's just a person from the orchestra. So, for instance, where we're sitting, it depends how it goes. So it's normally like, you know, Anne McEnany, Paul Beniston, Lyndon Meredith. And then one tour, we had an oboe player called Jenny Brittlebank.
And
I knew she was Jenny, but I didn't know her name was Jenny Brittlebank. I don't think she knew many loads of people in the orchestra. But when we'd done like 12 verses, and when she was sitting next to Lee, our tuba player, so it would always go, everyone in unison would go, Jenny Brittlebank, and an
LF30. You know,
yeah, because it was perfect, Jenny Brittlebank. That was quite fun.
I've never heard that song the same again.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, such good times. Touring can clearly be fun, especially if you're on Bus 3. Sometimes things don't always go to plan. Violinist Min Majo and horn player Mark Vines shared some of their touring horror stories with us.
Our principal cellist, Christina, found it quite funny when we went to Taiwan because she had to put her cello in a big body bag, basically, which just looked ridiculous.
And some airlines insist on the cello being upside down or something like that because it fits better in the seat. It's just, yeah, it's bizarre.
Oh my goodness.
Speaking of instruments upside down, I remember doing a tour a while ago, and because the double basses, they have special flight cases, more heavy duty. But I remember one lady arrived home and the double bass was upside down, and I don't know how long they'd kept it upside down for. I don't know how they did that or why, because there are many fragile stickers and this way up, but obviously something got lost in translation. Anyway, she opened the case and the neck had come apart from the body of bass.
No.
So, which was pretty bad, very bad.
I mean, the way horror stories go, I mean, that is just horrific, isn't it? And usually you're opening the case before a rehearsal or, you know, even for the concert when you get to the hall. What happens then? I mean, what would have happened in that situation? Would there be a backup?
Well, she saw that it was upside down, so immediately she opened it to check. So that was at the airport. So she, I don't know what she did after that. Probably managed to find a spare somewhere and get it fixed.
If you're on the tour already, it's normally a case of trying to track down an instrument to use for that night and potentially the rest of the tour. Finding qualified repair people all over the world, you don't know where you're going. You often have someone that you trust back home. So that's why the more valuable your instrument, and if it's small enough, people do tend to take them. And there's also a big difference with long haul and going to Europe, because with Europe, we'll take a truck across. And so we have our own crew dealing with the instruments day in, day out, loading them, unloading them. So you've got that trust, you know, the people that work for the orchestra who did a brilliant job looking after our instruments. And they do their best with the flights. They accompany the instruments to the airport. They oversee them loaded onto the cargo, and they oversee them at the other end. They oversee them going into the hall. They do their absolute best, but there's always going to be a period of time where it's out of their control, and it's at the trust of the airlines. So yeah, it's a bit of a fingers crossed moment.
Oh my goodness, it still gives me chills reliving that again, and that is why I try to keep my saxophones with me whenever I'm on tour. Well, when not on tour or in the concert hall, LPO players are often to be found recording film music in a studio. Here, principal tuba player Lee Sarmaklis takes us behind the scenes in a film session with John Williams. Could he see the film on screen, or was he looking at the dots?
It depends. I was fortunate enough to be involved in the recording of The Revenge of the Sith, John Williams' huge orchestra, Abbey Road Studios, and the film is being screened behind you. So John Williams is conducting without a click track, and he's basically, there's a red line and a green line, and they run parallel. So he's watching that, and he's, as soon as he passes the green line, he starts conducting, and he's basically doing it in the sort of old school way. I don't think anyone does that anymore that I know of. And so you're recording certain sections of the film, so you can get a sort of, you know, a vibe, so to speak. But I think nowadays you turn up, sometimes there's not even the whole orchestra there. It's just a few brass players, and you're laying your bit down. And you have no idea what the movie is. You know, you just see a Q1 or Q2, but you know, I think most experienced musicians, as soon as the music starts, you sort of know what they're after.
Well, how we record film music has certainly changed over the years. Double bass player Simon Carrington also shared a memory of recording in the 1980s.
The first film that I was lucky enough to do was a bit of a flop, I think, actually, but it was back in 1989 with Elmer Bernstein.
Whoa.
And it was called Slipstream, and it didn't go anywhere. But it was very interesting for the reasons that Lee's outlined. You know, this is Abbey Road 1, you know, the iconic place. Yes. Elmer Bernstein was there. I think he probably had some sort of TV screen right in front of him, but he was doing it old school. And he was just watching these ribbons, as Lee said, they come across the screen, 1, 2, 3, 4, but, and that's where the shot changes. Mm. And so he, at the end of that bar, has got to catch it. Yeah, and this is the first time, because the music is the last thing to go on to a film.
Yeah.
And maybe these days with special effects to add, there's much more of that, obviously, but basically it's the last thing. So he'd be playing this through for the first time. And I just remember that he could watch this thing, the ribbons are coming by, just carries on. This is about maybe 2 minutes worth of cue.
Yes.
And then he got to the end of that. He said, right, okay, let's change that after B to a 3-4 bar there, and then make that a 5-4, and all of that, and adjusted everything. Yeah. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, let's do it again. And second time, not third or fourth time, second time. It would be perfect. And that was, as Lee's saying, a proper old school way of doing it. But that's even, you know, in the old days of the full orchestra being all, in all of the studio.
Loads more from Simon and Lee on playing music for the big screen in our Music from the Movies episode. Do check out the whole thing if you missed it. Now, as a saxophone player, I'm often having to transpose, so I really enjoyed hearing trumpeter Anne McEnany explain the quirks of transposing, basically playing notes in a different key to how they're written.
I suppose it's not like it being in a different language, but visually it's different. You know, the notes are in the wrong place and you have to do something intellectually different instead.
Wow.
Like I said, instead of transposing up one tone, so playing each note that you see up a step, you have to, when it's in A, read it down a half step.
And why can't they just give it to you in B flat?
Because it wasn't written in B flat. I mean, sometimes you will, and it's something that annoys us, actually. We are used to transposing because we have trumpet parts in A, B natural, C, D, E flat, E, and F.
Wow.
And you can probably imagine, as we're pitched in B flat, that trumpet in E is not our favourite.
No.
Because it's an augmented fourth.
Yeah. Well, I'm a tenor, so I'm B flat, E. And if anyone calls E, I go into a cold sweat. But I do find it fascinating that you still have to transpose as you go. It can't just be transposed and given to you.
Yeah, we don't want it like that. I mean, it looks wrong.
You don't want it?
You know, no, it doesn't look right to us.
Right.
Yeah, we spent years training to transpose, you know. We don't want to waste that talent.
Yeah. It is a talent indeed, trumpeter Anne McEnany. That clip was from a fascinating deep dive into Stravinsky's Firebird. And talking more technicalities, in this series we also did a deep dive into Brahms's 4 symphonies, and it proved tricky to pick our favourite. And discussing Brahms more generally, we tried to pinpoint what it is about his music that makes it so rewarding and sometimes challenging to play. Here's clarinetist Tom Watmo.
It's funny because I'm doing his class and it's purely about articulation. And I've set the students a bunch of excerpts a little while ago. And I realised it's very Brahms heavy. And this is for articulation. This is just for the beginning and the ends of notes. Also, if you can put legato in that category as well. Brahms asks all sorts of things. He asks for an absolute perfect legato. The expression is in its coolness, is in its like organ-like quality. But the beginning of notes and the end of notes, the way these start, you have to be, everybody has to have it, be thinking as a wind section, a string section too, no doubt, exactly the same way.
Yes.
But the way you sort of punctuate the just the offbeat crotchets at the beginning of Brahms 4, say, everybody together with the softest of starts, and that's the way it works for me. Sometimes I've been in a wind section and where somebody doesn't get that. And there's this kind of bite to the sound, yes, of some of these things that should be soft-edged.
Yes.
And it's those are the things I find very frustrating when people don't get that.
It is a fine art, the intricacies of articulation, how your tongue hits the reed. Really interesting talking to Tom about that. We had a few special guests join us this series, including opera singer Brindley Sherritt, who let us in on how he's preparing to sing for the role of Hagen in Wagner's Ring Cycle.
Hagen has a line where he says, "My blood runs cold." He's, because somebody says to him, "Why are you not happy?" He says, "I don't do happy. I hate happiness." He's that kind of character. So, but he's a manipulator. Mm. He's a liar. He has this one goal in mind, and he'll do anything to get it. But and also vocally, it actually says Schwarzer Bass at the beginning, which means literally a black-voiced bass.
Oh, wow.
Which is very dark color that's shown. And that's fine if you're a Schwarzer Bass like I am. That's great. But he also writes at extreme of the bass range, very, very, very high. You're talking 2.5 octaves, you know, two over 2 octaves easily, and very, very high and very declamatory. And but there are also wonderful sardonic moments in it too, but it's physically incredibly demanding. And because I've not done it before, there's a huge risk involved in this, you know. and Court Maule is famous for saying, "Oh, it's you can wreck your voicing in this role. It's for a shouty bass." And I had a long chat with John Tomlinson about this, who's done many Hagens. He's a very famous Hagen. He said, "No, you just sing it." if you know what you're doing, you can get around it that way. But it is a kind of, "Oh, here we go. Hope I make it to the end" kind of role.
For real? Oh, yeah. Well, to hear that from you and to know that you're going to be embarking on this amazing performance, yeah. We fully support you. I know it's going to be a fantastic ride. Tell me about what you're prepping now. This is for this. How long is the performance going to be?
With intervals, it's getting on for 6 hours,
wow.
I think. This is the longest of all of the operas in the Ring Cycle.
Yes.
I'm prepping by doing a lot of listening to people who had done it many more times than I have. So listen to lots of old recordings. I like to listen to the old Germans singing it and the way they do it, because it's also very helpful for me for the way that they colour the text.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm not trying to memorise it yet. I'm just trying to sing it and sing it and sing it so that I can get the character into my body. And I'm trying to get it into my voice, into my body, so the muscles know what's coming up. And a lot of that can happen subconsciously as you get to know, like Fiona will say this, and maybe that you're playing an instrument or you're singing, but you need to know it in your body so you know what the next bit that's coming up. You're preparing yourself mentally and physically,
yes,
to do that section. Well, you only get that by repetition.
So when you're learning these enormous roles,
yes,
is it just the repetition, or do you have to consciously think, "I must learn this bit"?
It's a bit of both, I find, but I've learned that it's what you can do, especially if you've left it a bit late to memorise. You think, we only have 12 days rehearsal. For this 13 days, whatever, which is quite short for a 6-hour opera, 5-hour opera. So I normally, if I'm doing a long role like this, so for the first time, you'd want 6 weeks rehearsal to get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of, doesn't matter, I've done a scene where I forgot everything, it's okay, it doesn't matter, I've got another 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever. If you've got a matter of days, that adds a lot of pressure. So that's my process, is just to listen to other people doing it and then sing it over and over again.
top tips on how to prepare for an opera there from bass Brindley Sherritt. Well, last series we did a deep dive into Holst's The Planets, and this series we decided to revisit it because a new facsimile edition of the work has been released. A facsimile is essentially just a photocopy of the autograph manuscript. But what did principal conductor Ed Gardner think when he first saw it?
I'll tell you something, my initial reaction was negative, and it's very strange, yeah, because I opened the first page of Mars and you got most of the da-da-da-dum-dum-da-da-da. And for us, that our intensity is 100%, yeah, when we're playing that. And he just writes bloody repeat signs through the thing, so he doesn't even write it out. But of course he did, because we're used to computerised scores now, so we never really see that anymore. But that immediately made me, yeah, shut it, and I had to come back to it later, because there's an intensity that we give that isn't necessarily on the page at the moment.
It's full of repeat signs, and that's yes, partly to save himself. He loved being able to write repeat signs.
Yeah.
Whether that actually conditioned the music to a certain extent, I don't know.
I thought about that as well. I don't think so. No, but just as a performer, to read that sort of lack of complete, you know, you wouldn't see Beethoven doing that as he scrawled all over his
brother.
This Jackson Pollock scores of Beethoven, he'd work it, and he'd put every little accent on and every little staccato. But then, as I delved deeper into it, I found some really beautiful things. And as Colin said, the one movement that's all in his own hand is Mercury. And it's like a pointillist painting. It's so beautiful. If people aren't playing, he doesn't put the rest signs in. So they're just empty canvas and these little winds. And you can actually visualise the sound of his orchestration, the delicacy of his orchestration. And that was very special for me.
Principal conductor of the LPO, Ed Gardner, on his initial reaction to seeing Holst's autograph score of The Planets. We also heard from composer Colin Matthews. And finally, three former members of the orchestra joined me to talk about life after the LPO and what retirement looks like for each of them. Violinist Jeff Lynn wishes he'd done more teaching.
I realise now I would have been much happier as a person teaching than playing in the orchestra. It's a whole different experience for a rank-and-file violinist than for a wind player, because there's only one Joan and there's only one Gareth, but there are 16 of me, and it's not an interesting... I didn't find it an interesting experience. You don't take any decisions musically at all. If you play extremely badly, it doesn't matter. Yes, for Gareth and Joan, it would be a sort of nightmare if they had a bad night.
It's fascinating how experience varies so much from instrument to instrument. When oboist Joan Graham retired, her relationship with music changed completely.
Well, I couldn't listen to any music for ages, for years after I left. I found it very upsetting, and I think my sense of identity went when I stopped playing the oboe, which is a pitfall I hadn't anticipated, really. But now I just love listening to all sorts of music. I've still got a CD player. I listen to lots of Mahler and jazz and stuff and everything. So it's delicious not to have to worry about it.
Yes.
Just listen to other people doing it, not worrying about your reeds playing up or getting there to do it. You know, no pressure. Just press a button.
I'm looking forward to that, yeah. Can you remember when that turning moment was that, you know, listening to Mahler didn't bring sort of the sad memories but actually made you look to the future and enjoyment?
Yeah, it took about 15 years before I could listen to Mahler. Yeah, it just made me cry. It just made me cry, especially our recordings of it with Klaus Tennstedt. Yes. You know, all my old friends from that particular era, a lot of whom have died now, were on those recordings. And, you know, it was heartbreak all over again, like when you lost them, you know.
Yeah.
But now I can do it as a piece of music rather than the individuals playing it so much.
And for bassoonist Gareth Newman, retiring from being a professional musician brought up some big emotions.
I suppose spending most of my life being involved in it, it was the last thing I felt like doing when I got home was to, you know, turn on a CD player or a record player and listen to more music. So I tended not to listen to music at all or completely different sort of music, jazz or something. And since I've stopped, it's the same story, really. Like Joan, it's sort of too close, too raw to the process. And it's very hard to listen to uncritically, because having spent your whole professional life being hypercritical of yourself and, of course, your colleagues, naturally, it's extremely difficult to listen to music without doing that automatically. But just to say, it's quite strange being back in Portugal because this is where I began my career. In 1977, I came out to Lisbon to play in the Gulbenkian Orchestra, and I was here for 4 years, which is what cemented my love for the country and the people and everything else. And since I've been here, I've been to a couple of concerts, and the most important one was in January when it just happened to be the very last concert of the only person who was still in the orchestra from when I left in 1981. And she at the time was a 19-year-old who just joined the orchestra, and now she was a 60-odd-year-old retiring from the orchestra. And it was very, very moving.
Oh, what a beautiful and emotional story. He had us all in tears there. Well, so much honesty from those three retirees from the LPO, Joan, Gareth and Jeff. Really worth catching up on that retirement episode. Well, that's it for now from LPO Offstage with me, Yolanda Brown. In this highlights episode from Series 7, we heard from trombonist Mark Templeton, violinist Min Majo, horn player Mark Vines, tuba player Lee Sarmaklis, double bass player Simon Carrington, trumpeter Anne McEnany, bass Brindley Sherritt, clarinetist Tom Watmo, conductor Ed Gardner, composer Colin Matthews, violinist Jeffrey Lynn, oboist Joan Graham, and bassoonist Gareth Newman. If you'd like to hear more stories, thoughts, and memories from any of the musicians you heard today, you can check out all 7 series of LPO Offstage, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us along the way, and stay tuned as we'll be back again soon with a brand new podcast. Bye for now.